Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 4, Please Hold to My Hand, which is an awkward title at best. Aaron, how's it going, man? I didn't see you for Sunday night's show, so I don't know anything about your opinion on this yet. I'm excited to find out.
You could have consulted the instant take, but I was broadly in favor of the episode. I really liked it. I'm curious because I don't, and no one else knows what your opinion. So what? Spill it. Spill the beans.
It's true. It's true.
Spill the can. The Chef Boyardee.
Yeah, it's not quite 20 years old, but it is 2 days old. I like this episode. I think, look, they can't all be contenders for the Emmys, but this episode certainly holds its own. I like to see, you know, we kind of predicted, hey, maybe just give it a second. I think Ellie and Joel are going to bond a little bit more. You're not going to really have to worry about, we're a third way through the series and we haven't bonded them yet. Yeah, we got a lot more of that this episode, and I was happy to see it. It was also a lot of fun in those moments. I'm a child, much like apparently Joel and obviously Ellie, and I really appreciated the runs in your jeans joke.
It's a good one. It's a good one. Good quality. Will Livingston or whatever his name is really knocked one out of the park there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing is like I didn't have to wait to get this episode to like really warm up to Bella Ramsey, but like if there's any, I guess, people holding out about whether she could kind of channel all the different wavelengths of Ellie, I think this episode puts those to rest because she's also able to, you know, maybe Ellie's not innocent. Maybe Ellie has had a little bit more familiarity with violence and death than a 14-year-old should, but she's still very much a child. And I thought Craig Mazin had a really great line about how people don't usually write teenagers very well. They either portray them as much too young mentally and emotionally or like as essentially full grown adults. And he said that there's this tone of fuck you, now tuck me in to like a 13, 14, 15 year old where it's like they definitely are becoming their own person and their intellect and their maturity is kicking in and they're, you know, rebelling and acting out, and which is just another way of saying they're differentiating from, you know, the hive mind that is the family. They're splitting off, but they still have some of the needs of children. They kind of want to know that there's someone beyond their own selves, like in charge, and someone's protecting them, someone's looking after them, someone's going to care for them. And I think that Bella really nails that. Like,
oh yeah.
Very, very well. And like I said, that was the one concern I had going into the project is can she do all the things that Ellie has to do? And by God, she does.
Yeah. It's ironic how well it's done here, given the other character that Bella Ramsey, that I'm familiar with of Bella Ramsey's, that's from Game of Thrones, where she was basically like an 8-year-old who was acting 100% like an adult.
Yeah. She was Ned Stark really reincarnated in a 9-year-old's body.
Yeah, exactly. So
she had the Lord's face and everything.
I'm much happier with how they're portraying that here. Yeah, it's great. It's a lot of, I guess, cyclical things happening in this episode where, you know, first Joel doesn't want to talk about his experiences. Now Ellie doesn't want to talk about hers. And you can see the walls coming down, but it's slow, right? Mm-hmm. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be one pun and suddenly they're best friends, but
yeah,
it is getting there. We're inching toward it.
Yeah, I agree. I saw that. You know, last week we diverged wildly from the show or from the video game's canon, I guess, or the events as portrayed in a video game. This episode we hewed very closely. There, I saw a lot of like shot for shot, you know, stack the scene from the video game of like Ellie finding the nudie magazine for men, stack shot of like the actual ambush that takes place in the video game, and it follows very close. Now there definitely are, I'm not even say deviations, there's some embellishments to the canon, you know, this Melanie Lewinsky, someone's Lewinsky. Making fun of me for pronouncing her name wrong in feedback I saw this morning. Kathleen, this is a character that's been invented for the show to kind of put a face on these militia factions that you sometimes, you know, these or, you know, they're not raiders or just rabble trying to survive. They're not Fedra or Fireflies. They're this other, they're the people, you know. But I don't know. I'm curious to see how that goes. I saw some people like grousing that there's been a little bit of grousing of what was perceived as attempts to whitewash Joel's character. But I don't know if I agree, or if I do agree, it's in the exact same way that like they whitewashed the character of Tyrion in Game of Thrones. Like in the book, he's a little, you know, a little bit more darker and unrepentant. And some of the things he does, he's a bigger asshole, but I feel like whenever you're adapting something from like a book material, or I guess a video game where you're directing a character's actions to something where you're more passively observing and you don't have their interior voice and you don't get to guide their directions, that like you have to soften them a bit, because like, yeah, like if a person's acting like an asshole and you don't have their internal monologue explaining why they're doing the things they're doing, they just look like an asshole. So like I feel like maybe they've smoothed out the relational curve between Joel and Ellie. I'm not saying it's better than the video game, but like I'm not feeling that at all. I wondered if you felt like, boy, it seems like Joel's just a fundamentally nicer dude in the show than he is in the video game.
Maybe slightly, but I don't know that I'm bothered by that, because he was kind of a dick in the game for a long time. And I don't know. I have to see how we get to the end point, I guess, of this season before I can judge it, because there's still a lot to go. We're not even halfway through this series yet, even the first season of this series, so give it time. I don't know. It changes aren't necessarily bad, you know? I get it. Yeah, people revere the game, but also the game ain't perfect. So,
and the game will always be there to play exactly as it is.
Oh, of course.
And I don't, you know, I'm not a big fan of just changing for change's sake. I don't think that Craig and Neil are looking to do that. It doesn't feel like it. But because they did mention something that made me a little afraid on the official podcast, which is they do look to make changes because, you know, the game is the game and they kind of want to surprise video game veterans, too. I don't think that conflicts with the earlier statements where when they are contemplating changes, they say if it's the same or worse, then they stay the video game. But yeah, I guess, yeah, all the changes made so far, like adding a representative to this militia group, you know, deepening Frank and Bill's character, maybe smoothing out. Maybe Joel's a bigger dick to Ellie in the beginning of the show than he is in a video game, but he's not as big a dick in the midpoint as he is. So it's like kind of smoothing out the relationship, literally smoothing out the voyage. You know, they're stretching out they're making intentional choices of where we check in. When I mean say where, I'm talking about not just in a stream of time, but geographically where we're checking in with Ellie and Joel to kind of smooth out timelines and logistics for. To me, it's like it feels a lot like what Dan and is it Ty? Yeah, Dan and Ty did on The Expanse, where it's not that the books were like a rough draft, but they're like, you know, we see a chance to smooth something out that we came across in book four. We can go back in books one and two and like introduce this character early. I think that's just really smart adaptation. And that, I think, is what we're seeing on the show.
Yeah, I want to see where they go with the Hunter stuff with Melanie Lynskey's character, Kathleen, because the one like criticism that I'm tending to agree with, but giving it time to develop to see what story they're telling, because I think it's necessary, is that she doesn't seem to have the commanding presence I would expect of somebody who has taken over a group of revolutionaries. I think that's the point,
Yeah.
But I need to see more to know for sure, because this could be a misstep, but this could be right on. So I'm curious
about
that. It's funny
because, so I'm glad you said that, because I can actually talk with you, talk you through it. I saw that a lot of people saying that on like the subreddit and mm-hmm. different reviews and things. I didn't get that at all. I didn't get that she was like a lightweight. And like, I feel like maybe if I hadn't seen Yellow Jackets, that I would maybe like balk harder at her stepping totally. Into this kind of like commanding role. But I'm like, I can mm-hmm. definitely see it. And maybe like I was thinking about my reaction, because this came up in the instant talk where people were saying like, do I buy that? And I'm like, I don't know, man. I just feel like, yeah, she definitely plays like nicer, more matronly characters, but she also has this kind of like wrought iron interior that, you know, she showed in Yellow Jackets that I kind of like buy her and just kind of like a person who could inspire but maybe is having trouble transitioning from populist leader to like, oh shit, I got to get stuff done. Like, this is, they mentioned mm-hmm. that on the podcast. Like, this is revolutionary politics 101.
Obviously, yeah.
But you don't buy her just as a, you like, it's like, why would the Perry guy, for example, why would all these tough paramilitary guys like defer to her?
I'm not necessarily saying I don't buy it yet. I want to see more. That's the thing. She comes off as very like, she's got a dark side. She can be, I guess, authoritative and in charge of certain types of people, but maybe not everyone. And it depends on what the people around her are like and how she ultimately grows into that role, I think, over the next episode. But we'll see. I'm not completely sold, but I'm not turned off yet. So
okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we get into the episode.
The thing I like about her performances is she always brings a bit of like warmth to her characters. You know, she's got a weird dichotomy in her style mm-hmm. where she is like both very warm but has like a dark streak and can have like this real mean streak too. Her performance in Yellow Jackets is really good, and it walks that line so well.
I agree,
but I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. I get the feeling they're going to a place where like she's kind of fucked up by the things that happen. Like, she mentions, you know, her brother getting beaten to death and all this stuff. So yeah, I expect more good stuff from her. But that's kind of where I'm at with the episode. I think it was very good, but man, you hold it up next to the last week's episode and it's like, how did you expect it to hold a candle to that thing, right?
Yeah. And it's solid. It's a solid part mm-hmm. one to what clearly feels like an old school two-part episode. You know, like, come back next week for the thrilling conclusion of
totally.
Please hold to my hand.
All right. Well, maybe we should get into the recap.
Before we do, I got two announcements to make. All of it's good news. First, even though they went head to head against the Grammys, The Last of Us said we don't want any of the Super Bowl smoke, and they are moving the premiere to Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO Max and HBO The Channel. And Jim and I are also moving our Instant Take and Instant Talk to right after the airing on 9 p.m. Eastern. So it'll be about 10 p.m. like we usually do on Sunday. Exact same thing we do on Sunday, except we're going to be doing it on Friday night. So we'll all get to enjoy the episode and the podcast for the entire weekend. Of course, the Instant Take will be out for everybody. But if you want to watch us record live, if you want to participate in the Instant Talk, if you want to download and enjoy the Instant Talk, get to support.baldmove.com before Friday and get signed up to the club. Correspondingly, since we're getting the episode early, we're going to get it out, the full episode out early next week, too. We're going to be releasing that on Monday afternoon. So, or probably Monday early evening. I don't see any reason to mess with the feedback schedule, though.
Nope.
So that'll still be coming out on Thursday, but we'll be having a slightly hurry-up version of the schedule. So that's exciting, good and good news. I'm glad they're doing it, because number one, I was going to miss the Super Bowl instant talk because I was going to be at my family's house watching the Super Bowl with my sister. So I'm glad.
I see where your priorities are. I see.
Well, look.
One of those fair weather
look,
Last of Us fans. Okay.
It looks sleepyhead. let's not talk about our commitments to The Last of Us. On a related note, we killed it this weekend on the Groundhog Day Marathon podcast. We're not Marathon podcast, Marathon Live Watch, where we watched all of the Fast and Furious movies to raise money for the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. I say we killed it, but I mean the Bald Move community. We raised $22,375 in cold hard cash, plus at least another $1,000 in proceeds going and revolving around bits and channel subs and merchandise. It was a success. We shattered another record. I didn't think we'd ever beat the record we set last year, but we keep doing it. We will be having a wrap up podcast probably out next week when we have a chance to get with the Cure Alzheimer's Fund people and do a little interview, and me and Jim can kind of like reminisce. It was a great time. Things got weird in the wee hours of the night like they normally do. There was some ChatGPT madness.
Mm-hmm.
There was some ton. We had a lot of fun. If you go to twitch.tv/baldmove, in the VODs, you can see the full 24-hour thing if you want. There's also a bunch of clips if you want to see just kind of Dixie cup-sized portions of the madness. Check it out there. Also, if you're like, oh, man, I missed this, because a ton of people were reminded. A lot of people, when they're logging in, said that they heard the reminder on the Last of Us Feedback podcast. If you forgot and you're like, oh, no, I missed it, you can still donate. We have not sent the check out to the Cure Owls people. We won't until we do the final podcast. So if you want to pump up that number a little bit more, groundhog.baldmove.com still has a link that'll take your money. You can still check out get one of the Fast and the Generous exclusive t-shirts at merch.baldmove.com. All those proceeds, again, 100% go to the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. So thanks again to the Bald Move community for making our annual fundraiser bigger, better, more fun. Can't wait to do it again next year. All right. Good news out of the way. Let's talk about the depressing nihilism of The Last of Us. Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss.
Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Just so we're clear about back there, it was either us or the ad. Welcome back to more Savage Starlight. All right, we start off with Ellie practicing looking tough with her new gun. Joel siphons gas for the truck as Ellie tries out some puns on him. He's not amused. They get back on the road where Ellie finds one of Bill's magazines and a Hank Williams tape.
Yeah, I mentioned this on the instant take, but it just viscerally makes me uncomfortable to see children playing with guns unsupervised.
Sure.
Like, yeah. I know she's not going to accidentally shoot herself in the face, but the whole time she's like handling it and whipping it into the mirror and stuff. I'm like, oh God, just please don't shoot yourself in the face.
She's got some training too. Apparently the Fedra school part of that is teaching you how to at least load a gun, load and unload a gun.
It's grim, right? You think about like, oh my God, you got schools teaching children how to be proficient in firearms, but then I like, oh, and we live in a society where we have active shooter drills, so I guess if our schools would be invaded by mushroom people, you would want the children to be able to arm themselves.
Totally. That's a very different world. Yeah.
It's a very different world.
I would want everyone to know how to use weapons in that world for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that they at least, I don't know that the answer is satisfying, but they at least sketched an answer about how Joel is getting gas and whether gas is still good. Or
it's not satisfying in any way. I looked it up, and impossible. Yeah. Impossible.
It doesn't slowly turn to water. And if it did, guess what? Your internal combustion engine cannot run on 90% water.
Yeah, it would just destroy your engine, apparently, if you try to put this stuff in it. So, no. Why do this? Because I would buy, there is a scenario I would buy, which is Bill had been actively making gasoline somehow. Or straight up making it. I don't know. He had access to the raw petroleum to
do it. Or it's a diesel truck, and he's doing biodiesel. He's essentially vegetable oil.
And he's got 350-gallon drums of it, and they strap it in the back of the truck. They didn't need this, and it's
got a 1,500-mile range, yeah.
It's not realistic. Why would they do this? And look, I know we're talking about Walking Dead mushroom people, but like, this is an unforced error. Why?
It is. I think it's because most people don't know it. Like, we're the 5% of people that know that gasoline doesn't...
Then why even have him say, like, oh, it's 90% water now, so we got to get a lot of it.
So they can tell us at least they know that this is wrong and then don't worry about it. I don't know.
Sure.
Cover
their asses.
Actually, I was trying to figure that out, too. It's like if you saw a show using silencers and it was using that zing, zing that the silencers used to always do in the 80s when you'd shoot somebody. And Joel's like unscrewed. I'm like, well, you know, Ellie, silencers don't really sound like this. Uh-huh. Like, okay.
Who's that for?
Now you put a lampshade on top of the lampshade now. It's weird, but they addressed it such as it is.
They did. They did.
The joke book came out. I was glad to see that. It's a big staple. Ellie needling Joel with her stupid joke book.
Yeah, and I like Joel trying to explain how siphoning works. That was kind of fun because I think everybody is in that boat, right? Like, I know it does work, but I couldn't tell you the exact mechanism through which it works.
And also there's this thing like Ellie finds this Hank Williams tape and she's like, oh, this must make you nostalgic. And that's such a kid thing, too, that like as now I'm my parents' age, I realize when I was a kid, I thought anything that wasn't essentially in the late 70s, or early 80s was like from the aforetimes. Mm-hmm. Like I was embarrassingly old. Like I think I was 8 or 9 before I realized that the world just wasn't black and white. And when they discovered, like, they didn't discover color. Like, it's, no, it's, the world's always been in color.
Hmm.
They just started filming it that way. To, like, my dad was not the generation that enjoyed King Kong, for example, or even, like, The Wizard of Oz. Like, he was after all that. So I just thought that was funny when he's like, this is actually before my time, but still, absolute banger. And, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's exacerbated by the fact that everybody got, like, reruns on TV. So you'd always hear classic stations, right, on the radio. So there was kind of a big overlap. There could be, like, 20 years before you were born, 20, 30 years.
Sure.
Where you were very familiar with that stuff. But, yeah. Yeah, you're not.
Yeah.
All time didn't happen during old people's lifetimes.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of shows before my time, like Beverly Hillbillies and Dick Van Dyke Show and things like that, that I have a nostalgic for because that's what they played when I was homesick or played on Nick at Night and things like that.
Totally.
I like that. And then the gay nudie magazine, this is essentially a shot-for-shot remake of what happens in a video game.
Yeah.
And the thing I think is really startling about The Last of Us, when I was watching some of these comparisons between the video game and the TV and the TV show, their facial acting on these games are just so much next level than anything we'd seen before. And then you get to part two and it's even that much. But, like, Joel gives a subtle performance in the game of, like, being visibly uncomfortable by Ellie discovering this nudie magazine and looking at an implication of pages being stuck together. Because, you know, games, like, I'm thinking of, like, playing the original Half-Life. Games could show, you could show a person, like, screaming in terror or standing at attention, but not much in between. But here you're, like, this is a person being fatherly embarrassed about his daughter getting involved in tangentially sex stuff, and Pedro doing it too is just, I don't know, I thought it was really, really funny.
Yeah, I think it's hilarious when she throws it out the window, bye bye dude. Pretty good.
How does he walk around with that thing, Jim?
I don't know. Alone and Forsaken, I guess, is the Hank Williams song here. There was a Hank Williams song in the game, but it's a different Hank Williams song.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. I think it's called I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. In the game.
Another good fit.
Yeah, totally. They got a thing for Arby's, apparently, because there's another Arby's reference. It's that Love's sign, truck stop sign, that you see. There's an Arby's underneath it. So, like, what's their thing with Arby's? Is Arby's just a fun restaurant to include and stuff?
I used to like Arby's. I think it's nasty now. The last time I had one of the roast beef sandwiches, the roast beef was a very thin layer. It was kind of greenish.
Got to get the Big Montana.
I used to love a beef and cheddar, and a beef and cheddar is just sad now, man. And they're expensive for what they are. Paid $5 for a couple of folds of beef and some sad nacho cheese.
I never liked the beef and cheddar, mostly because of cheese, and it can't have gotten any better during the apocalypse, right?
Oh God, no. Yeah, yeah. It's post-apocalyptic food in the pre-apocalypse.
Really is. All right, Joel and Ellie stop to eat dinner and make camp for the night. They try to sleep in the woods while worrying about people potentially finding them. While Joel wakes up in the middle of the night to make sure they're safe. You can tell it's bothering him.
Oh yeah. They're eating. I didn't look up whether Chef Boyardee would stay good for 20 years, but I've heard that cans kind of do stay good forever,
Something defective about them, like if they get an opening on them somehow. Yeah,
because there's just no way for bacteria to get into it. Now it might taste like hell, but like it's not going to kill you to eat it.
No, I think ravioli would last longer than gasoline, that's for sure.
canned pasta. You can only burn a car will burn on beefaroni.
Shove that in your gas tank, see what happens. get a stick and jam it down in there.
Plunge it in, pack it in.
Of course, this is like the obligatory people are the real threat scene. But they are in some ways, you know, at least in a lot of scenarios.
Well, we also get like some people have had a question about mushroom biology, about how smart are they? Can they absorb people's memories?
Yeah,
like we
yeah.
hear a professional mushroom fighter here, Joel, say that like they're not even smart enough to see smoke and fire and assume human activity. Mm-hmm. So I think this puts like, you know, the kiss scene might have like anthropomorphized this thing a little too much, but I think this puts an upper limit on like these. Yeah, you can think of these as just pretty much like zombies. They're fast and they're agile, but they're not going to like outthink you or outflank you or things like that.
Yeah, yeah. They have one thing on their mind, and that's to spread themselves to other hosts.
100%.
And they don't think about how they're doing that. They just like see, oh, there's a host. Let's go after it.
Yeah. And it's they establish this like, you know, child parent type of thing where, you know, Ellie wants to know if they're safe and Joel assures her that she is. But as soon as she goes to sleep, he's out patrolling because he's not going to take anything for granted.
Yeah, for sure. The next morning, Ellie wakes to the smell of burnt shit, aka coffee, and they continue driving. Ellie asks about Joel's brother, Tommy, and he explains how Tommy got mixed up with the Fireflies because he wants to be a hero and save the world, which Joel thinks is all incredibly delusional. And they keep driving. Ellie falls asleep at some point.
Yeah, the wake up scene where Ellie was slow to get out of her sack, I thought that's like, man, it's just that's camping with a teenager. Trying to get them out of their warm and snug sack in the morning and go out and hiking.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of coffee machine that he was using? I've never seen anything like that before.
No, I don't. It looks like
the
coffee
boiling
was bubbling
action
up
was
from
forcing
the...
like mm-hmm. through something that was like forcing water through to percolate it.
Yeah, I think that is a like real type of coffee maker. I don't know the term for it though.
What do you think it would be like drinking 20-year-old coffee beans?
About like it is drinking 20 day old coffee beans. I don't think there would be much difference, honestly.
Is it bad or is it just like, you know?
It's probably roughly the same.
Hmm.
So it depends on your opinion of fresh coffee, I guess.
Because like Folgers, that freeze dried shit, you could drink coffee forever as long as you keep finding that stuff. But I was wondering, like, does the bean go bad? Does it ever, you know, bar getting moldy or whatnot, like, would those beans, like, still deliver caffeine and flavor for 20 plus years?
I don't know. That might be the question. Like, is he actually getting any caffeine from that? I was just thinking all about it from, like, the perspective of don't you dare let her drink this coffee because it's one of the highest crimes you could commit in the apocalypse is to get someone hooked on coffee when it's not being made.
It's true.
Like, you're not living in Bolivia, so I don't know that you're going to find many coffee
Juan
trees
Juan Valdez
around.
Isn't coming over that mountain range with his
no,
burro loaded. No, uh-uh.
So, yeah, don't. Here's my advice. Maybe this needs to be a ball move rule. If you're in the apocalypse, don't get addicted to coffee. If you aren't already.
That's kind of like real life, you know? Just if your natural metabolism isn't doing it, Don't take the crutch because you'll depend on it and you'll resent its absence.
Fair. You know what you don't resent the absence of because it's never absent is 70 West or 70 East for that matter. So I love the fact that they point out we're going to be on 70 West for like ever.
Boy, it feels like it too. Every time I went out to Colorado to ski, it's like you get on. I mean, you never like you, I it's like I
thousands
our
of miles.
Hometown was 5 miles off of 70, and you got on that and just like, oh my! And some of the most America's a beautiful fucking country. Let me tell you, oh my God, Monument Valley to Southwest, the Colorado Rockies, Eastern Seaboard. We just got the Great Lakes. We got some goodies. The Pacific Northwest. The Midwest, there's a lot of flat areas and a lot of corn, a lot of just a lot of continental crust that got pressed flat by glacier and not much else, man. It's rough. It's really, really rough to drive through,
especially where they are in this episode, the Kansas City area. Yeah. Driving through Nebraska is no fun. I'll say
so
that.
A lot of people on the instant take, and that's continued on through the week, have called into question, like, why are they taking this route? This is not the best route from Boston wherever they're going in Wyoming. And I said on the instant take that I didn't really care, because I can think of a million different reasons why a guy in the apocalypse would know. It's like, well, you just can't go north. You know, the winter cycles just pulverize the roads, so you can't make good time. There's known raider bandit camps. This highway is closed.
14-year-old girl who's never been in a car before as my navigator, so I should probably keep it simple.
Right. Because I noticed that the map was marked up a little bit with, like, some areas were shaded in red that were, like, I don't know, no go. Like, did they nuke that area or something?
They
so, like, I didn't care, but, like, listening to the official podcast, this also was a conscious choice to... They had this... this place that they were filming in Canada that is not Windsor. What the hell was it?
Vancouver. No, I don't know.
Yeah, it's whatever. Calgary? It's Calgary, I think. They're filming in Calgary, and they're like, this doesn't look like Pittsburgh, which is where this scene takes place in the video game. It actually looks closer to something like a Kansas City. Also, you know, we know where we're going in the game, and geographically and geologically and time-wise, if we move, you know, we give them a little bit more time to get to know each other before this chapter, and then we're a little bit closer logistically to some of the things that are going to happen next. Like, it seems like it's a good decision, and if it's not the Google Maps approved way to get there, I don't care. I don't think it's an interesting thing to talk about.
Okay. So let's talk about the more interesting part of this scene, I guess, which is the reasons that Tommy joined up and how Joel feels about that. Because we were wondering, and I don't think we get too much more information here, but we do get at least a reason from Joel's perspective as to why Tommy joined up with the Fireflies. It's because he's kind of a follower, I guess, and he wants to be important. He wants to save the world. He wants to be a hero, that kind of stuff. Which Joel thinks is all incredibly naive and ridiculous.
Pipe dream, delusional. That's how he frames Tommy and all the people like him. He draws a direct connection to the Fireflies there, too.
Uh-huh.
Marlene being the one to convince Tommy to join up. I thought that was an interesting detail.
Uh-huh, yeah. It implies probably longer-running... relationship with her. I'm curious when all this happened too. Like, okay, how soon after the apocalypse did Tommy join up with the Fireflies? How long was he with them? How long ago did he leave? All those things.
This is unspecified time of them running with a crew that was effective and got things done before they got to the quarantine zone. So I was wondering that myself.
And then Ellie, you know, throws the obvious kind of in his face, right? Like, if you don't see any hope or purpose, then why are you still fighting? Why are you out here doing anything? Why aren't you just laying down in Fungusville and letting them eat you? And he claims it's because he does have a purpose. It's to keep his family safe. And she's not part of that.
But she's... promise, a contractual promise, so she's kind of sort of to a family,
right?
She's an obligation to a dead family member, which makes her, like, I was, the way he says just cargo was so brutal. I don't know, it didn't
and
feel
this
whitewashed
is the part
to me.
Of Joel felt, that like it is not white, the whitewashing stuff, right? This is Joel still being very much game Joel,
desperately trying to stave off a feeling of obligation to this girl. Like, I am responsible for your safety, not as a promise I'm keeping, not as a fool's errand I'm trying to run, not as like a side bonus for going to find my brother, but like, I don't want to care about you in that way because I don't want to be hurt. You know, I don't want to be hurt like I've been hurt so many times before.
Yeah, and I guess, like, I'm not really... When I'm looking at this episode, I'm saying, okay, well, yeah, Ellie got Joel to laugh at the end of this episode, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she's no longer just cargo. It means she got him to laugh. Lines like this kind of say the exact opposite. You know, he's keeping her at a distance here, or trying to. But yeah, she seems to be slowly whittling down his defenses.
They mentioned this on the official podcast too, that there's a certain resentment to Joel, like being forced to be the guy. Like, his brother's the idealistic dreamer, and he's the one that always goes off and saves him, and and finds him and keeps him safe. Like, you know, he had to bail him out the night of the pandemic because he had to get involved in saving somebody. He joined up with the Fireflies, or went along the Fireflies, just to keep an eye. And you can tell that it kind of grates on him. But they point out that this is also Joel's core identity, that he is that guy. He kind of loves being that guy. He complains about it, but it's his identity. And I thought that was a little unsatisfying, because I think it's, I don't know that he loves being the guy. I don't think he knows how not to be, because, like, essentially to not be the guy, you have to essentially shrug your shoulders and be like, well, I'm just going to let, I guess I'm going to let this person fail or find out on their own. I'm not going to go with them. I'm not going to care what happens to them. I'm going to trust them to make good decisions. And, like, that's a more healthy thing to do than to be the guy or the girl.
Can be, yeah.
But, like, it's also, like, boy, you feel it requires a certain amount of strength and trust and faith in other people that I don't think Joel has. So I don't know that Joel loves being this way. I just don't think that he knows any other way to be.
Yeah. I'm definitely not getting the sense that he really enjoys coming in and saving the day for people. I think he's more like, well, someone has to do it, and there's no one around except
right.
for
everybody
me.
Else has gone off being a goddamn hero. So I guess I'm the one that's left that can do the thing that needs to be done.
Yeah, I almost get the feeling that he resents it. Like, he would prefer to live a different life, but these chuckleheads around him are not letting him.
Or there's actually a really great character moment in this completely unrelated movie, this Disney movie, Encanto, right?
Okay.
As one of the, you know, all these children of this magic house have this particular blessing. And there's one of the daughters, the sisters, that is just phenomenally strong. She's like a Hercules. She's strong. Everyone relies on her when it comes to feats of strength or protecting. She has this great song about, like, that's all great to be known as this big thing, this big, you know, that everyone can rely on you. But, like, what if you can't do it one day? What if you are, like, and Joel is a guy who's had to live through three different occasions of that happening. Mm-hmm. That, like, he is the guy that everyone relies on, and he wasn't strong enough.
And
I think that fucks
with
you.
He needs somebody's help. You know,
sure.
Like, that's the other, the flip side of that is
he can't ever,
he's
like,
the protector. Who protects the protectors, right?
Yeah, the pressure that you yourself can't ever be the one that loses their shit and falls apart and just says, fuck it, you know, everyone else will figure it out, because you are the guy that does that for everyone else. It's like, it's an immense amount of pressure.
Yeah, totally. I love the road trip, the strong road trip vibes that they're giving me throughout this scene here, especially when Ellie says, oh, I'm not even tired. And then we smash cut to her just zonked out in the front seat.
Yeah.
That feels so much like a road trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I've been doing this a while, every time Jack falls asleep, like, it just in a car and just, like, throws his head back against the rest and just, like, mouth gaping open like a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do this when he was in his car seat. So I've got an own broken picture. And I'm like, I wonder, like, when is the last time I'm going to get this shot? And it hadn't been, it'd been for a while, but just like, I think the last time we went to my sister's house, what was that for a Christmas thing? He did it. And I'm like, I got a 16 year old picture of him doing the kid sleeping. But yeah, you're not gonna fall asleep like that in your 30s. You won't be able to move your fucking neck when you wake up.
Fair. They've really done a great job depicting, like, the perfect road trip, right? You got the beef jerky. You've got the ability to just fall asleep while somebody else drives. You've got
dad siphoning
no
gas at a restaurant to stop. Yep,
right,
all the
stopping at
points.
The Arby's. I mean, I don't know how your family did it, but yeah, we didn't have money to
gas
cross
is expensive.
Country,
come
right?
on, you can either have the hotel on the beach or the gas to get there. Come on,
yeah,
you got to make choices.
See the dinosaur park, or you can suck the gas out of this car, kid. Get to
right,
it.
Right.
No, and then you have an just like totally unencumbered, no traffic highway. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Ellie wakes up at the entrance when they get to the entrance of a tunnel. This is the other road trip thing. You fall asleep from, you come down off your beef jerky high, you fall asleep, and then you always wake up when the car slows or stops, right?
Yep.
It's you never wake up and you're traveling 80 miles an hour down the highway. It's, fuck, where are we? And your parents have pulled off to get, like, coffee or food or something.
Yeah, the disoriented feeling of, where the hell am I? What time is this? What is happening?
Yeah, so Ellie wakes up. They're at the entrance of a tunnel which has been blocked just outside of Kansas City. They decide to drive around the tunnel, and they end up getting funneled into an ambush. Joel manages to take out two of the ambushers, but a third sneaks up on him. He's going to kill him, but Ellie shoots the guy in the back. And then she doesn't actually kill him. Joel has her leave the room. He finishes the job, and then they kind of sneak out of the immediate area there.
Yeah, I loved all the details of this. It really did make you, it really captured the feeling of terror and helplessness when you get into these gunfights. I really liked how, like in a video game, you can hear what the other side's screaming and yelling at each other. So it's like, you know, they're not speaking a different language. They're not, you know, faceless like stormtroopers. They're actually getting angrier and angrier at you as you have success at killing them and getting more and more desperate. How fucking powerful Joel's gun sounded. My God, and that thing goes off, it feels like it's going to put someone down, and it does. I will say that, like, I was watching, you know, because when I was watching the guy go check on his buddy and he turned his back to Joel, I'm like, now's the time to kill him, Joel. That's standard operating procedure. You kneecap the guy. When they check on their wound, you need to kill them both. Like, come on. You got to be more ruthless than this, Joel.
Yeah, it's all part of the whitewashing of Joel. The softening of Joel. No. There's a moment there that I really like at the beginning of this where they're at the tunnel and Joel's looking under the truck, the trailer rather for the semi there. And he sees like unobstructed road in front of them. And I think this is the moment where his radar is kind of going off, like saying something is not right here, but he decides it's not worth backtracking. How much gas has he drank at this point? I mean,
right.
You can only siphon so many times before your stomach is just full of gas. So he's like, I don't want to siphon more gas. It's going to be miles and miles and time. And, who knows what we're going to encounter out there. We're already here. Let's just go around. He makes a bad call here against his better judgment, too, I think. They end up getting in a lot of trouble.
Well, I think that you like it also captures one thing the video game does really well is puts you in this natural rhythm of like you will just be talking around and just fucking with Ellie, just walking down a path and she's telling jokes and the game is gorgeous. You hear birds singing and you could go there for what in video game feels like a long time where you even forget that like, oh, there's danger. And then a rifle cracks and suddenly, you know, you're running for your life. You get complacent, just like in a video game, you get complacent. And I think that's what Joel is doing. He's been, you know, rolling for thousands of, you know, for at least 1,000 miles, let's say, Boston to Kansas City. That's at least 1,000 miles. Hasn't had any big contact. He could go back and do it right. But like, you know, what are the fucking odds? I don't know. I thought that again captured the feel of the game.
Yeah, in the game. I remember they do one thing in the game to undermine that feeling, though, with the music. They always like cue you with the music, whether you're in a battle or about to be. Or whether the battle is over, especially. So now it's time to, you know, do the tin hand monkey technique.
The unrestricted looting.
Loot the zone. Here in the game, or here in the show, rather, I definitely feel like I'm lulled into a false sense of security and then boom, I'm hit with something.
I thought they did a good job contrasting Brian to Ellie. That's what I thought anyway. It's like, you know, Brian's got Joel pinned to the ground. He's choking him with the shotgun and he's just some lunatic asshole trying to kill Joel. Ellie shoots him and he starts crying for his mom and saying he can't feel his legs and saying that we're not fighting anymore. Now he's like, what is he, 15, 16? He knows that he's probably not going to make it out, and he's trying to bet. He thinks he might have an angle with Ellie, but when Joel comes to and gives him one look, then he knows it's going to be fucking over. And I love the choice. This is very video. I love the choice that Joel murders this kid with the knife rather than a gun.
Yeah,
because
makes sense.
Bullet shells are precious. He might only have a handful of them, and he ain't going to use it on this kid.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you beat a lot of people's heads in with bricks and the last. That's the thing about The Last of Us is The Last of Us might be the most brutal combat I've ever seen in a game.
It's pretty brutal.
Yeah, really feel like these are normal, untrained people trying, like, in an animal way to kill each other. Because a lot of times they don't have ammo. They're swinging, like, a kitchen knife duct tape to a 2x4. And that's not pretty when it hits someone's head.
Nope.
Yeah.
That
feels like that. It's very desperate. Felt very desperate.
Yeah. And this is where I start to really like the episode significantly. It's when we see... You know, Ellie has done something in this scene that she knows is wrong, or at least against Joel's wishes, which is she had this gun without telling him. And there's this palpable feeling of like, shit, I'm in trouble. Like, I just saved this man's life, but he could just as easily spin around and, you know, get incredibly angry because I've done a thing I knew he didn't want me to do. And that tension is preserved like through several scenes here until Joel starts apologizing later. And I felt it. I was like, I was trying to put myself in Ellie's situation thinking, man, how do I, you don't want to just like throw in his face. Yeah. Well, I saved your ass with that gun.
Right.
Cause it's not, that's kind of not the point in a weird way in that moment. Mm-hmm. It's like, you shouldn't have that gun in the first place. And yeah, there's this really good emotional tension in these next couple of scenes for that reason.
Watch out for that fungus. We'll be right back with more Savage Starlight.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight.
Yeah, and a lot of it is like it's not that Joel's not angry, because I think that's like what people are like, the whitewash thing is like, Joel should have been angrier. He should have literally yelled and scolded her. And in this, Pedro just has his eyes blaze and he like yanks the gun out of her hands and tucks it angrily in it and like stares at her like, it's, you know, it's not, I don't think abusive, but it's the parental way of like rubbing a 14-year-old's nose in something that they've done wrong. But Joel's not really mad at Ellie. He is mad at himself because he fucked up again. After all this talk about, oh, I'm going to find my brother because I'm persistent, mm-hmm. and I'm, you know, and I guarantee you there's not going to be, like, he let this kid get the drop on him, and had it not been for Ellie disobeying him, he probably would have been dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pissed off at himself and retroactively pissed off for being more concerned with this girl having a gun than he is with the reality of what they're dealing with. So, like, he processes us all that through the scene and then says, I think the right thing, which is like, I fucked up. I'm sorry that you had to do that. That was hard. And now I'm not going to make the same mistake. Here's your gun. You know, now you can protect yourself. I thought, like, again, I...
And he's mad this girl who he thinks is an innocent at this point, right? And might be, I don't know, she says something later like, okay, it was my first time hurting somebody in that way. But, like, we don't know the circumstances around that. And Joel doesn't know that at all in these scenes.
She certainly doesn't have Joel's experience.
No, not even close. So he's, like, doubly angry at himself. He's angry at himself for fucking up and almost getting killed and letting down somebody, you know, who may not be family, but is definitely a promise to family. But he's also angry at himself, I think, for letting this young girl be traumatized by having to save him. You know, it's twofold, his disappointment with himself. And I really like it. It's probably for me the best part of the episode.
And I love how I let Ellie play, too, because Ellie plays this. She's weeping in the next room as she hears this kid getting stabbed to death. And they made it in the official podcast that she's not weeping because of the loss of her innocence or anything. She's, in their opinion, weeping because, or she's, this, those are tears of anger that she has allowed herself to feel sorry for this kid. That she, you know, and then like in many other lesser productions would have Ellie be the innocent and she would beg for this kid's life. Oh, Joel, you know, he says he's not gonna, you know, he's gonna go right. What's good? And Joel would have to be like, you stupid kid, this is the, you know, you don't know what it's like out, you know, give a Rick Grimes, you don't know what it's like out there, Ellie. And she doesn't, because she's not naive like that. She knows what has to be done, and she's pissed because she's emotionally feels sorry for the kid.
Yeah.
Of having a human reaction. And when Joel comes back in a room, she's like in kid makeup mode where, you know, you fucked up and you're trying to get on mom and dad's good side. She's all fucking business. She says she's all good. She's got her shit ready to go. She's saying, where we go next? I am back into like listening to everything you say mode. And I like I said, I felt like it was better than if Joel just berated her and tore her down and did all that stuff. Like I felt, it's a more nice character narratives, a smoother arc for him.
And in some ways, it's more devastating to me. I'm like, well, if she had, you know, showed some emotion and begged for the kid's life and Joel did it anyway, like,
yeah,
that doesn't say traumatized. That doesn't convey the amount of damage that has been done to Ellie emotionally. Both now and obviously in her past, what does convey that is her saying, her jumping right back up and saying, "Nah, I'm good, let's go."
Yeah,
that to me is almost worse. That she isn't really willing to process, you know, the idea that she had to kill someone who's not much older than her. Honestly, this kid couldn't be more than 18. So
yeah, I think he read to me like 15, 16. But,
right.
So probably in real life he's 22, but
yeah, of course. He might be up to 30. Who knows?
Because Bella Ramsey's 20, right? I think I saw that.
Is she?
No?
I don't know.
She's 19. She'll be 20 in like 6 months. I can't believe how convincingly she plays like a 14-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
So totally. That's like, you know, this isn't, we're not in a 90210 age where you got 30 year olds playing. No, you got an almost 20-year-old convincingly playing someone that's an eighth grader, essentially.
Did you see the movies that were playing on the theater at the theater in the street here?
Yeah, oh God, I made a note in the live watch and it didn't for the instant take it didn't come up. It was the Happening?
No, it was Underworld and Matchstick Men.
Matchstick Men, yes, that was the one.
Interesting combo
that jumped out at me. Yeah,
yeah,
funny. Are those boy, those must be Warner films that they don't have to get any permission probably. To clear?
Anyway, let's move on to a woman named Kathleen, played by Melanie Lynskey, interrogates her doctor, trying to get him to give up the location of a man named Henry. The bodies from the encounter with Joel are brought back, and she blames their deaths on Henry. And she goes back, kills the doctor, then demands a full sweep of the city to find and kill Henry and his collaborators.
Yeah, it's not that she's single man. I kind of thought that in the first watch through. My second watch, I realized that she's looking for a lot of people. She's naming these names, and there's some kind of flicker over the doctor's face. He's got to tell that she knows that he knows more about Henry than he's letting on. I don't know why the single-minded focus of Henry for the rest of the episode. It might just be that she's not very, very good at her job.
Or that's the lead she's got. I don't know.
Right. She's clearly a leader of this popular uprising against Fedra. She must be some kind of like inflection point, the death of her brother in these holding cells. Like there's all this lore that they hint at, they're not running it down for our convenience. They're just gesturing at these things. And like the doctor must have, I don't know what it means to be a collaborator. Was it like just literally he provided medical services to Fedra? In fulfillment of his Hippocratic oath, that she implies that he informed on his neighbors, but is that informing like when your neighbors are Firefly terrorists, or is that like informing because your neighbors are, stealing a few ration cards so they can feed their children? Like I don't know.
Yeah, they do a lot of a lot of fairly subtle storytelling here. That you can kind of glimpse the edges of, but I don't have any like concrete information.
It's wild.
Yet.
Yeah. It's usually when you see a scene like this, it's in a setting where there's clear stakes and you have clear sympathies. But like, you look at the sentence, like if you're sympathetic to the doctor, then it seems like real shitty for her to put a gun to her head. But if you're like, if this doctor is some kind of like Nazi collaborator, sure. And he's like, oh, but you understand, they have a gun to my head. And she puts a gun. I thought that was a great line. She's like, well, now I've fulfilled the necessary conditions for you to talk. You have a gun to your head. So fucking spill it.
Yeah, I'm naturally sympathetic to the person who is being obviously beaten. Right. He's bleeding. So he's been beaten. Having a gun put to his head and saying, tell us what you know. I'm sympathetic to that person naturally. But I don't know the full story here, and I don't know who these people are, what they've been fighting. Obviously, we've seen a QZ before, so we know that Fedra can be pretty shitty. So we kind of want to be sympathetic to Kathleen's group here, because it seems like they have fought Fedra and won here in
popular revolution from the people.
And I'm typically for that. But
there's
signs
that there's something not all's right, because I thought that the performance here of Kathleen was very much a person losing control of a situation and fixating on things like that scene of her like discovering Brian's body and realizing there's some outside. She's like, well, maybe it's a Merc. Maybe Henry brought, maybe he's got a radio. Maybe he brought him in. Like suddenly everything is connected. And if you know what it did, it felt like late game Cersei to me. Where a person is making what they think is logical inferences, but it's really just a whole bunch of unconnected casual relationships that they're making causal. And that's, and wanting to take swift action rather than gather more information. So like my priors tell me that she's not going to be a really effective leader, but she was a revolutionary figure, and whether that translates well into civilian control, it doesn't seem like it is.
Yeah, it's an open question. I do wonder, is it possible that Brian was her son? Because he's shouting for his mom, and I don't know that this is necessarily true, she doesn't react like super strongly as far as like, oh no, my boy's dead, but she definitely kicks the thing into the high gear at that point, right? She's like, find Henry, kill every single one of these people.
I don't think, because like, if it, that was her son, when Perry came up and said, we found these bodies, they wouldn't say Brian, right? They'd say your son, right? Or your boy.
Maybe. I don't know. Everybody's like standing there.
That's what
the,
I'm
the
thinking.
The crowd parts when she walks up in a way that like says this is important, not necessarily like this is just a person in charge. I don't know. Well, but, I'm thinking we might
like,
find
there's
that
definitely
later,
his but. Dad, I think you're supposed to understand. His dad is like at his side, like weeping over the body. And if that was his mom, I don't think so, but I couldn't prove it from just the text, I guess.
Yeah, it's not. It's definitely not textual.
The other thing, there's many, many things wrong going on here in terms of leadership and whatnot. But I think chief among them is this also opinion that, because that's what I got, that the doctor, she's like, well, will this guy live? There's another guy who was shot, but he's not dead. He's dying. We'll live with the doctor's help. And they're like, no, he's too far gone. She goes in and immediately shoots the doctor, because I guess that's what stayed her hand. He said, my God, I'm your doctor. Like, maybe your only doctor. Mm-hmm. This idea that if something's not 100% effective, it's useless. Like, I've seen this kind of line of thought a lot in the last 10 years or so as a way to, like, dismiss, you know, things that, again, don't work 100% of the time, like science and
like
medicine.
Literally everything.
And like, yeah, like everything is like, you know, and to seat belts and just everything. It's like, oh, a doctor can't fix this. Well, fuck it. Doctors are useless and should be shot. You know, it made me really angry to like see that happen, because, you know, even if Joel doesn't kill every motherfucker in the city, which he probably not. That's you just made your group materially weaker. You had a trained doctor and you just blew his brains out.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to keep him chained up in a cargo container until you need him, that's more valuable.
Yeah.
Than him
make him treat people's strep throats and broken arms and, you know, deliver babies. Apparently, that's an important part of civilization, too. Like, I just, oh, God, the small mindedness. That's what it's like. As soon as I saw her do that, I'm like, I am not sold on her. Nope. She's going to be a terrible leader.
There's a lot of reasons I'm not sold on her. That's certainly one of them. I don't know. I'm curious to see if I'm going to hate this character by the end of her story, or if I'm going to understand her motivations, feel her pain, and come around on her. I don't know. I guess the overriding feeling I get on her is that she's almost in command here, in control by default. Like, she happened into the position of authority she was in during the revolution, and once the revolution was over, everyone just kind of still looked to her for that reason.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm curious to see if she is actually a capable leader in her own right, or if she just kind of was right place, right time, and will be ousted at some point.
Now, revolutions are scary. I think we have an unduly high opinion of them in this country because that's how we were founded. But if you look around the history of revolutions, like 95% of them are bad, worse than what came before, especially in the near term. So not often do you get just like a stable, high-minded, represented democracy out of the affair. And I don't know, maybe Kansas City will have will do better, but... Not
like
Kathleen at the helm.
I like that she's also blaming Henry for this incident, right? It's like, oh, must have been someone with Henry, must have been like related to our current thing that we've got going on here. Right. So let's double down on that. Whereas Joel and Ellie had nothing to do with that. They just wandered in. They weren't sent by Henry. They weren't part of the collaborators, none of that stuff.
And, you know, if it's not clear already, it will become clear that like who... she's losing her shit over, you know, like, is he a military genius? Is he someone with lifetime of experience of leading counterinsurgencies? Is he got a person with a ton? Is he a warrior with tons of experience killing and all that? Or is he going to be a scared, you know, essentially Brian, you know,
Brian?
I think, yeah, the kid that got killed by Joel.
Oh, that Brian. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, like what we don't know at this point in the episode, what the fuck is Henry? Who is this guy? And it's going to mm-hmm. make her position even more weaker when we come to appreciate who she's talking about.
Yeah. Perhaps. We'll see. Joel and Ellie watch the city sweep happening here, and they know that they have to move. They pick a tall tower about four blocks away, and while they wait for the coast to clear, Joel apologizes to Ellie for getting her into a situation where she had to shoot someone. Joel gives her back the gun and shows her a better grip, and then they move out.
Yeah, it's like emotional. I mean, this is, you know, teenager 101, too. They're, like, on these emotional whiplashes. I saw someone said that, like, dealing with toddlers, like overstimulated or overtired toddlers, is like dealing with drunk adults, and you use the same tactics, mm-hmm. like kind of broadly speaking patronize them, like, oh buddy, oh man, that sucks, hey, here's some water, let's get you to bed, come on, no, yeah, it's terrible, oh, I mean, we'll just, you know, you treat them like that, and instead of getting angry with them. And I find that, like, dealing with like 12 to like 15 16 year olds is like dealing with an adult rolling on Molly. You know, they don't have, they're not accurately picking out dangers versus the, you know, everything is like, you know, wild swings of emotion, super high regard for their current ability, constantly horny. just like, yeah, they're not drunk. They're no longer drunk adults. They're now adults rolling on a Molly trip. And that's what it felt like, where it's like, you know, Ellie goes from feeling like really, really bad and like on the verge of weeping and like opening up to this guy. And then he shows her how to hold a gun properly. And she is like over the fucking moon. I like that detail. Again, she feels authentic.
This is Joel hugging her, right? Like what she needs in this moment is Joel to come over and give her a hug. Yeah. And yeah, just like, just let her know that everything's going to be okay. He's not going to do that.
No,
what he's
going
to do
is
show her how to properly hold a pistol, right?
Yeah.
And I
love because
that.
Joel is the guy he is, telling her it's not her fault and a sincere apology gets most of the way to where a hug mm-hmm. would do it, you know? Because like she's just like, realize he's not capable of one thing, but he's doing everything he is capable of.
Yeah, the thing that's happening also in this scene, though, is he is just, he's trying to protect her from her own feelings. And I, you know, because this apology, like, strictly speaking, I don't think Joel is at fault here. I don't think it was that Joel got her into this situation that, like, he should have seen and could have known and could have protected her from. It's just like they got in over their heads. It happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not really his fault, but he feels like it's his fault. And then he's telling her that it's his fault to protect her from feeling bad about what she had to do in that moment. And I like it from every angle. Like the stuff between Joel and Ellie in this episode is really strong.
Yeah.
Because it hits from so many different angles, like I said.
Yeah. And it's like you were saying before, it's like when you find out that it's not her first time, that's actually more sad.
Yeah.
You know, you're only 14 and you've had, you know, you haven't quite got a callus built up, but you're working towards it.
And I do want to know more about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like this information coming out in drips and drabs where it's like, oh, man, there's so much. You can tell there's so much story behind that. Like, oh, my gosh, when is it going to come? When are we going to find out?
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, you can't just have him teach her how to hold a gun and everything is right in the world. She also has to try and tuck it into her pants, and then Joel gives her the classic Christmas story line, you'll shoot your damn ass off, right? That's what Santa tells him.
Right. Shoot your ass out.
Shoot your ass out. No. And then I find it hilarious that she doesn't put it in her pack, right? She's like, oh my God, we just went through this. You did something that Joel didn't want you to do.
And it saved his life.
I know. She would obviously point that out if I told her this. But like, it resulted in a whole bunch of emotional shit happening. And now you're going to do it again, just immediately next, right? And that feels like a teenager too.
Well, it makes sense if you're rolling on Molly, Jim.
For sure. So that's in her pocket. Do you think that's going to come back to bite her, or is it going to like save them again like it did the first time?
I don't know. If it comes back to bite her and her ass gets shot off, I don't know how that improves the story. So probably not.
Okay.
Maybe get her a holster. Maybe take a holster off of one of these dumb fucks you're going to be killing in the weeks ahead.
I could see somebody maybe, I don't know, grabbing her and taking this pistol. Whereas if she had it in her pack, maybe it wouldn't. And then like using it to, I don't know.
God, it just seems like in this world, like, I mean, why not even be more safe and have her keep it unloaded? You know, it's like, are you going to be less safe with her? Maybe someone sneaking up and taking the gun, or getting in a situation where she in a frightened state is fumbling with her bag, trying to get the gun out, rummaging through the sack while Joel is getting eaten by a clicker. I don't know. Like it's honestly an open question, right?
Yeah, I mean, earlier in the scenes with Brian, she waited until the last possible moment to get that gun out. If I were her, I get behind that wall, I immediately grab that gun. But
yeah, I was thinking that too.
She seems hesitant to do that. Obviously, she's not supposed to have it.
Well, some of that's filmmaking. They're like trying to build the tension, right? Yeah. She just like had that gun out ready and just blasted a guy from the hole.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's true.
That's what I'd do in the game if I was playing at Ellie. Uh-huh. I would have gotten to where I was just barely able to see that guy's head from the hole. No reprisals. Thank you very much.
All right, next scene, Perry takes Kathleen to a place where people, probably Henry and including a child, were obviously hiding out. She orders her guys to double the guards around their food stores, realizing they're out of food. Then Perry shows her another disturbing room where the floor is cracked and moving, and she tells him to seal off the building. What is going on in this room, man?
I think we might have to have a spoiler at the end here to speculate, because did you didn't hear the instant talk. Anthony, who has not played the game, was speculating that this is a mass grave. That may or may not be infected. I mean, it's got to be infected if it's a mass. That there is like a heaving mass of mushroom humanity under here.
They did like, show that pile of burnt bodies earlier.
Right. Maybe. Like maybe they executed a whole bunch of people and tried to concrete over it. And that was his speculation. I'm curious to see. That's the other thing. It's like I'm curious to see what people come up with. In the feedback section, and I kind of want to speculate with you in a spoiler at the end of this episode.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good,
because I think there's like two or three things it could be.
Here's my speculation: is that those drawings were not actually drawn by the kid; they were drawn by an adult who draws very poorly.
He drew so poorly they executed him, and now his frustrated art ambitions are trying to get out from underneath the floor.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think, because the thing is like the thing that is, I think, hard for me to wrap my head on is it seems like it's explicitly connected to Henry and Sam's hideout. Like it's in the exact same building. Is it a coincidence? Am I wrong that it is in the same building? And it's just more of like, hey, I was wanting to tell you this anyway, and they're a couple blocks away, or is it different? Like,
these didn't feel like the same building to me. One of them felt like a house.
Oh, really?
The other felt like a more commercial building.
Huh. Yeah, I thought they were shacked up in the dead space of like a warehouse or something. But
maybe
you might be
felt
right.
Like an attic of a house to me.
You think there's, man, yeah, okay, because yeah, though, especially the way they edited, where you didn't see an establishing shot of them arriving to someplace else.
Yeah, they didn't feel connected to me, but maybe they are. I don't know.
Okay, it's creepy though. It's like someone on the instant takes like Kevin Bacon's Tremors or there's graboids. Because, yeah, something, it's got to be something big and powerful or a lot of something to move that kind of heavy structure, a collapsed floor.
All right, Joel and Ellie break into the tower that they had their eye on. They climb most of the way up to the 33rd floor where they hope to get a better view of the city in the morning. During the climb, Ellie asks Joel again about whether he's killed innocent people. He still won't answer. They settle in for the night with Joel laying glass on the floor as an alarm. Joel asks Ellie about the people she's hurt before, and she says, "Eh, I don't want to talk about it either." Then she tells a real stinker of a joke, which cracks them both up. They eventually fall asleep, and when they wake, they realize they slept through their alarm, and there are two people with guns pointed at them, telling them to be quiet.
Now, when we go to the ad, make every shot count. We'll be back with more of Savage Starlight. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We're not the cure for mankind, but we have your favorite podcast. Here's more of Savage Starlight.
I guess I want to start here with asking, because there's this, you know, Joel's not directly answering the question about being on both sides of the ambush. And Ellie says, did you kill innocent people? Implies he kind of has. Mm-hmm. I wonder, is there any kind of moral system that would grant you the right to ambush and murder innocent people to survive? Like, it's one
innocent
thing if you steal
people?
From someone.
Hmm.
Well, because he says he's been on both sides of, I guess, the ambush. Like, he's ambushed people. By definition, you can't ambush people that you know are bad, right? I guess if you're ambushing Fedra.
Yeah, if you know who you're ambushing.
Maybe.
You can.
Okay. Because I was like, that's a really dark color to paint Joel with the idea that his people might have preyed on people to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you can maybe steal to survive. You can maybe hold someone up and be like, hey, we're starving. I'm going to take a third of your crap and then get out of here. And I guess if they fight back, I don't know. There's like,
yeah, then what
I
was
trying to think like Rick Grimes, like, you know, like they killed a hell of a lot of people, but they normally didn't like bait people, lure them in, trick people. They were mostly the ones being aggressed on. So I don't know. What's your thought? Do you think that Joel has killed innocent people? Because why wouldn't he just say, no, of course not?
Yeah. I mean, when you refuse to answer a question like that, it's because you have done things that if they weren't innocent people, you at least feel like they didn't deserve the fate they got.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like, that's the thing, is they're doing a good job of humanizing like this We the People outfit. It's like, you show Brian's dad mourning him. You know, these are normal people. These are people with families. They're not like psychos. Although, again, it's hard for me to square the predatory luring people in and stealing their shit and probably raping and killing them when you're done.
Yeah, that's the thing. They did ambush them. It's not like, it doesn't seem like Fedra's around anymore, right? So these are traps set for whoever stumbles into them.
Yeah. And maybe like if Joel had just come in and like helped the guy, they would have arrested him and taken his shit. Sure. And then who knows? So like, did Joel provoke this by trying to run the guy over?
Yeah.
I guess it depends on which side of the ambush you're on, I guess.
It really does. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about Joel's stories when, you know, this ice is finally completely thawed and he can talk with Ellie. Here's the thing about climbing all these flights of stairs. I feel like anybody in reasonable health could climb 42 flights of stairs in a night. Like you give somebody 3 hours to do this. I think if you can walk, you could probably get up that many stairs.
If a 56-year-old one with some injuries,
I mean, think
I don't
about
know.
It. If you took a flight a minute, it would take you less than an hour to get up there.
Yeah.
A flight every 3 minutes. You could do it in less than 3 hours.
But why do you
like
want
an
to get
hour
to the,
and a half.
Why do you want to get to the tippy top? I guess that's the question.
I don't know. It seemed like he wanted to. He just couldn't. Mm. So why does he want to is the question.
Do you... I don't know. I guess you're right. If you wanted to hike up all night long, you could. I was worried the whole time they were using their flashlights, swinging them around indiscriminately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there are people in the city looking for you. If you let your flashlight play outside this, or if you're walking up, you know, you're in a 33rd floor of the building and you got your flashlights out exploring the building. Like,
turn this thing into a lighthouse.
Yeah, it's going to look like the Watergate break-in. Like, people are going to notice right. At 3 o'clock in the morning, dude. There's there's people probably up late looking at it. But I don't know. I thought it's interesting he did that Mission Impossible trick of, like, spreading the broken glass. And Ellie asks if, like, are you going to even hear this? Because you seem like you're mostly deaf out of your gun ear. And turns out he doesn't.
And I love the detail that when he wakes up, he's on his left side, which means his right ear is up. So they might have walked on that glass. He just couldn't hear it because his hard of hearing in that ear.
Yep. I like that a lot. And it's funny because it's an inversion of your expectations from the game, because in the game, Joel's got almost supernatural hearing. Like, you got
absolutely.
The listen mode where you can kind of like really concentrate. And this is much more realistic. Yeah, guy's been doing gunplay for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're going to have some degraded hearing.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest departure this series versus The Walking Dead is accuracy, the hearing loss from firing guns.
Yeah, yeah.
Ellie asks, does you know, Joel's apologizing here again about, you know, having to hurt somebody. She says it's not her first time. He says, yeah, but you're so young, something like that. And she's like, does it get easier when you get older? And he says, well, no, of course not. It's just you do it enough times, you become numb to it.
Yeah. Get used
to
it.
It's not that it gets easier. It's just that it affects you less.
And it's like, you know, that's sad about, because like there are times in your life where you are carefree. And, you know, I don't know if like if it behooves you to go through all your life that way. But like, I think there's something to be said about trying to keep kids from experiencing the true, you know, daily worries and whatnot of the world. And that probably goes double for the zombie apocalypse. But, you know, Jesus, there's like, I think of that kid in the very beginning of the series that walked in from the outskirts of Boston and like what his life must have been like. And he probably saw his family getting eaten apart, you know, torn apart by clickers and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Got bit by one himself. They gotta grow up fast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different world than we live in.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm looking around at the online discussion about this, and I know everybody wants to paint the internet as a hive mind, right? And you've got all these, you want to paint it as like its own entity, but it's never more apparent than back-to-back Last of Us episodes. Last week and this week, that the internet is not a hive mind. But there are many different competing opinions because, boy, last week people were getting antsy. They were like, God damn it. We're going to go off and do this side story. We don't have time. We got to tell the story of Joel and Ellie. My God. We're going to run out of time to make them bond before the important moments. And this episode, it's like, fuck, they bonded them too quickly. what are we doing? We still have 5 episodes left. Now the whole pacing is ruined. I'm like, oh my God, just settle down, everybody. Settle down.
That's the thing. I just think people are like, and as a guy who processes all the feedback, it seems like they're antsy in 2 different directions. There's show only watchers that are like, why is everyone sucking this show's dick so hard? Like, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm watching halfly fleshed out characters and it's because you are this character. And then you hear the video game people who are antsy because, like, well, right, they seem to be killing it so far, but oh my God, I'm not sure if they're going to continue to kill it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, I feel like this show is getting a lot of the show only watchers are saying this is getting a lot of unwarranted love because why is it people acting like this is one of the greatest stories ever told? And we're only halfway through it, which that seems like it should be on the face of it dumb, but also. At this point, if you're a video game person and you are on the fence or like on pins and needles about them fucking this up, like you gotta relax, man.
Yeah, like, yeah, you gotta chill out.
If it's all about the culture war stuff, they've already fucked the thing up beyond all recognition because they made Frank and Bill Gay, so you might as well stop watching it. But if that if that's not your opinion, then like how in the world can you be afraid that they're gonna fuck this up? What would it look like? What would it look like for Craig and Neil to fuck it up at this point? Like, they've killed the casting.
Uh-huh.
They're following the important stuff of the that we love in the video game and clearly have a lot of affection for the source material. The big changes we were worried about, like spores and shit, haven't played out. Like, it seems like it's like, if anything, even cooler. Like, yeah, Jesus, just they're finally going to do a good video game adaptation, okay?
Yeah, I think it's just a demonstration that people like to complain more than they do praise. And I get it. That's natural.
It's easier. Yeah, but it certainly is.
Because every time it just feels very whiplashy, right? Because I do go on the Reddit and look at it and go, well, this is the audience in aggregate, as opposed to saying like, well, this is the contingent of the audience that is feeling this week like something was amiss, as opposed to the ones last week who felt something was amiss for the complete opposite reason. Like, it's hard to decipher the general yeah. feeling of this. I think the general feeling is this show is really good. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a game player, a show watcher only, whether you think that they're absolutely nailing character beats or changing Joel's character substantially, everybody's still watching it and loving it. I don't hear the complaints no. that I hear on other shows that do a much worse job of adapting something. I
always went through this with Rings of Power, where like almost everyone was open in, yeah. in open scorn of what was happening there. You know, you had the very minority of people being. Yeah. And it was beyond the like, oh, we, you know, because there's like initial backlash against black elves and dwarves and
the
this and
stuff.
That and the other. Mm-hmm. But like then also when the thing hit and it's like, oh, well, these characters kind of suck and this person doesn't make sense. And this doesn't, you know, like there's substance. Yeah. Nothing in that show is really working with like small yeah. exceptions. And this is the inverse where like almost everything's working except for small exceptions. And they might not even be exceptions. We just haven't figured, you know, seen the entire scope of the
right.
thing. I just keep coming back to like, if I didn't like, I always come back to like right before the season aired, Alan Sepinwall had seen all 9 and, you know, he writes for Rolling Stones. He's one of my television viewing heroes. And he said the whole fucking thing is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So like, that was, if I hadn't known that at this point, I'd still be like, well, there's no, yeah, because I respect Craig Mazin. Obviously, I respect Neil Druckmann. I had some reservations about the cast 4 episodes in, but like, I also, there's people that I really enjoy and admire their opinion on television, and they're saying it's going to be okay. So I think it's going to be okay, guys.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be okay.
No, I'm excited to see what happens next week. We get the introduction of a couple new characters. Mm-hmm. Don't want to say much about them, if anything, but they are part of the game as well.
Yeah, and we didn't talk about it, but like, you know, the Sam and Henry the thing I thought was interesting is they're you know, Kathleen's talking this guy like he is some Jason Bourne.
Uh-huh.
And we see what we see at the end of this, and you know, we saw their lair, they're out of food, it's full of superhero drawings, and then we see two young kids show up, one of them with a superhero mask painted on her face. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, these are new characters we're being introduced to. But it gives you another aspect of Kathleen. Like, really? This is the thing that you're bending all of your resources into stopping and finding? These are the leaders. These are the collaborators. How the fuck did either of these kids collaborate meaningfully with Fedra?
Yeah. It strikes me as a revolution in search of a new cause. These people are all geared up because they just took over this QZ.
And now they have nothing to do. Like, part of the reason Fedra is a bunch of fucking assholes is because there's no good solutions. There's not enough there's not enough to go around. Mm-hmm. The public execution is probably resource management as much as it is, they broke these minor laws. So it's like, okay, Fedra is terrible. You just took over. Now what are you going to do? What humane way are you going to allocate resources with, like, medical, food, those kind of things, bullets? How are you going to protect these people? From, mm-hmm. you know, you flung open the gates of Fedra. So, like, that's the thing. Like, you know, winning a war is easy. Governing is harder.
Totally.
Direct quote from Hamilton, the musical. So, we'll see. Kathleen.
It's always easier Kathleen to tear down Hamilton. To build up.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? One last complaint. This is the worst one. They keep bait and switch Savage Starlight on us. When Ellie saw that beat up magazine in the floorboard, I'm like, God damn it. Mm-hmm. We're going to get Savage Starlight, and it's the bearskin nudie mag.
Yep.
Ah! still no sighting of our namesake. Where are all the collectible comic books that Joel and Ellie are supposed to be finding while they're rummaging through places? They keep rummaging, and we're not getting any of the comics.
I'm sure they're just around the corner. The next episode, right. I'm sure we'll get a Savage Starlight appearance.
All right. We should have done an over and under bet at the beginning of the season. Damn it.
Yeah. Oh well.
All right. Is that all we got? Should I initiate the outro sequence?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we're gonna have a spoiler at the end of this, but if you have not played the games, in fact, I want to make this a super spoiler. We are going to discuss enemy types. Potentially from the second game. So if you want to, like, mm-hmm. if that doesn't bug you, if, like, reading a Game Informer wouldn't spoil you, then you can, you're welcome. We're not going to be talking about plot. We're just going to be talking about enemy types, but, like, it is going to be some knowledge from the second one. So it's a super spoiler. If you want to be completely blind going into Volume 2, The Last of Us, maybe skip it for this week. But for those of you that do not want these spoilers, you can get a hold of us at TLOU@baldmove.com. That's where you send in feedback. We'll be considering that Thursday. We will be having our instant take on Friday night. Everyone will get to listen to our instant take, but if you want to join and watch us record it live and get both halves of that, the Gemini's opinion and then the community weighing in and our responses to that, you want to be a club member, support.baldmove.com. Follow us at Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. And that's it. We'll see you on Thursday and then Friday to do the whole thing, to start the week sequence all over again a couple days early. Let's get into the super spoiler section. Jim, there's concrete. It's bucking and heaving like a Bronco.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell? What the hell's buried underneath there?
Oh, man. So there are a few possibilities. Let me throw one out.
What do you think of Anthony's? Anthony, mass grave. There's like 20, 30 people under there. They were infected with shrooms, and they're like the guy who survived the collapse in the sea store, and they're bucking and heaving down there.
It's a reanimated mass grave. It's not the worst theory. I would say, like, you know, the dead can't be infected, right? So, like,
true.
If they were actually dead when they were put down there, then they're going to stay dead. Maybe they weren't totally dead. Maybe they, you know, got
mostly dead, like Miracle Max would say.
I suppose it's possible. It's possible this could be a bloater just under the surface, like maybe about to crack up. I we don't really see in the game how any of these types of creatures are made, right? So
right.
I don't know how bloater is birthed. Is it just like a certain quality to a human that when it would transform into like a clicker, instead it gets all bloated up and
or is it just like if every click, just like, you know, one out of 40 runners turn into lurkers and one out of 20 lurkers turn into clickers and one out of 10 or 20 clickers live long enough and have the, you know, maybe it's because their bodies are bigger and they have more nutrients for the fungus to exploit, because I've noticed that all the bloaters are pretty big boys, pretty big boys and girls. I don't know if I've seen a female bloater, but like they have some mass even without accounting for the mushroom, you know. They look like they were husky.
Yeah, so I don't know, it could be that, but in the game I don't recall anything ever being started underground. Everything you encounter was and always is above ground.
Did they drop? So I was trying to think, like, how did this happen? Did the floor collapse on them? Did the ceiling collapse from above? Like, did this, like, so that they had a bloater in this room and they collapsed to stop it? Could be, because yeah, I don't know that if you left that guy in the C store for the Ellie stabbed, would he turn into a bloater? I don't know how they can do that underground. The other possibility, because honestly, this seemed bigger than a bloater. Like, the way that the pavement was rippling, it didn't look like a single, like, you know, Gregor Clegane type figure struggling to get out from underneath. It seemed like it was bigger than that. What do you remember the Rat King in Volume 2? That was the fusing of like five or six different infected into one fungal mass that came out like it was in the parking garage of a hospital, and it was like a rolling battle of this giant thing. I think it bust out of an ambulance, and then it could bust through walls, and like as you killed it, you like kill parts of it. It was like two bloaters, three clickers, and a lurker all in like one tangled mass, and they'd split off from each other. It's like it was fucked up. I wonder.
Sounds like it,
but I don't know why they jumped the gun. We haven't seen a bloater yet. Why would they go right to Rat King?
I don't know. They went to clickers pretty fast, which I was surprised by. But yeah, that I don't know. Could it possibly be that this is the first bloater that anybody's seen? Like, this is, bloaters are just now becoming a thing.
First bloater that Joel's seen. I guess so, yeah.
That anyone's seen. Maybe this is the first bloater.
Maybe it's a couple.
Period.
Also, it could just be two or three bloaters. Because, like I said, I don't know. I'm not going to be like, oh, bullshit if just one bloater pops out of that thing.
Right, right.
But
I mean, if it's some, like, what'd you call it? Rat King?
Yeah, the Rat King.
Something like that would certainly be very cool to see on screen. But it does seem a little premature, you're right.
This is named after, I guess, a medieval phenomenon, or maybe it's a foot, but like where like rats would get, you know, like plague ridden Europe would get so like disgusting and scabrous and matted in their fur, their tails would twist up, and you'd have like 13, 14 rats just in a ball, just a heaving mass of rat. And I think like Dungeons and Dragons leaned into that and called, like, there's an enemy type of a Rat King, which is like, you know, some kind of twisted form of these ratlings and whatnot. And of course, none of, like, because like I don't think any of these, do any of these enemies have official names in the game? Because I don't think the game, like, it's like Ellie, like when this thing busts out of the ambulance, and now like Ellie's like, well, I don't even sure it's Ellie. It might have been Abby. It's not like they're like, oh my god, it's a Rat King. It's just like,
right,
you're just running screaming for your life. The bloaters actually, I feel like bloaters did. There was a poster, a Fedra poster or something. That's like, here's the stages of.
Maybe. That might be right. I can't remember.
But yeah. It's a couple. I'm hoping it's a few bloaters or perhaps a Rat King.
Is it possible it's just like the underground mycelium or whatever from the
network? Oh, if it's just like network. A big tendril whipping, it's like it's going to be a mass of tendrils coming out. Whip, 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 everybody.
Oh, I don't know about like fast moving stuff, but like, it's growing up through the ground there, and there's going to be some kind of
bring all these mushrooms down on all the defenders just after they've destroyed Fedra.
Maybe.
Could be. That's a good possibility too, a fungal nerve cluster.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll have to see next week.
Did they build Kansas City on an ancient burial ground?
They
because that might be a thing.
Yeah, they did. They
wouldn't surprise me.
They just moved the headstones and tried to build a swimming pool, and it's not going to go well for them. All right. I think that's it for the Super Spoiler. Again, tlou@baldmove.com if you want to send us feedback. What do you think is underneath the concrete? What's in the box? And we'll talk about that on Thursday. And then again, we don't have much. We don't have as long as we usually do to get to the full answers. It's coming up Friday night. We'll be there with the instant take, instant talk, support.baldmove.com. If you want to join up the clubs, you can listen to that live and enjoy both halves of the instant take and talk. And then we'll be back next Tuesday with the full. Boy, jeez, everything is this hurry up after Super Bowl. We'll be back on Monday, rather.
Yeah.
For this week only, we'll be back on Monday with the full recap. So that's the plans. Thanks for joining. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.